Good morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Today's Monday, May 3rd, 2021. The time is 9:04. Please silence all cell phones. This morning, Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Olson, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Wilson. Senator Von Imhoff, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes. Very good. Okay. Senator Hoffman will be along momentarily. And myself, Senator Bishop. Today's agenda, HB 100, Extending Workforce Investment Award Allocations. And then after that will be SB 9, Alcohol Beverage Control. And with that, we're going to roll into HB 100. This is the first hearing of the bill. Our intention is to hear a bill introduction, set it aside. Representative Wool, Ms. Kukarik, would you please come forward and walk us through your presentation, then a sectional analysis.
Good morning, members of the Senate Finance Committee. My name is Adam Wool, representing District 5 in Fairbanks. We're here today to present HB 100, the reauthorization of the TVET bill, Technical Vocational Education Program. This bill will reauthorize TVET for 3 years till 2024. It uses 0.16% of unemployment insurance.
Can we turn the volume up, please? Or I don't know, if are there mics up, or could maybe you might want to pull? Okay, good. Thank you, Representative Wool.
Thank you, Senator. I'll start over now that I'm amplified. Yeah. Representative Adam Wall, District 5, Fairbanks, here to present the HB 100, the TVEP reauthorization bill, Technical Vocational Education Program. This program uses 0.16% of unemployment insurance receipts and provides grants around the state to many technical vocational education programs. The total of the grant is approximately $12 million, impacts thousands of students at many different programs. The largest recipient is the University of Alaska, which receives 45% of these receipts and distributes it to all their campuses around the state. There are many other colleges and programs that receive funding, including Avtech in Seward, Alaska Technical Center in Kotzebue, Ilisavik College in Utyavik, and many others. The version of the bill you have here has been unchanged in the House, and it was it's been unchanged since 2014 with who the recipients are and the percentages of the total fund that they receive, again unchanged since 2014. My staff Ashley Carrick can walk you through the slideshow, and any questions we're welcome to answer.
Thank you. Seeing no questions from committee members, Ms. Carrick, would you please go through your presentation?
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, Ashley Carrick, staff to Representative Wool. And I'll just briefly walk through our slide deck here and then quickly go through the sectional for the bill. So as Representative Wool mentioned, we are talking today about the Technical Vocational Education Program Reauthorization, or TVEP. Many of you have seen this information before, so I'll be brief and just do a quick review. This program was established under AS 23.15.830 in 2000, and it was created to provide non-competitive grant assistance to entities around Alaska that are providing industry-specific vocational and technical training. And in 2014, the legislature increased the funds diverted to TVEP from a contribution from unemployment insurance of 0.15% up to 0.16%. And the current bill before you would seek to reauthorize the program until FY24, or for another 3 years. Some of the training that TVEP recipients offer include industries that are in high demand across the state, including fisheries, construction, mining, information technology, transportation, healthcare, and other industries. This chart shows how TVEP funding gets distributed. The important point to note here is that the employee portion is where of checks is where the unemployment insurance receipts are drawn from. That's where that 0.16% comes out of and is diverted to both the STEP and TVEP programs. And then just briefly, on the next few slides, I want to go through the history of TVEP recipients over time, just noting that this has changed and these are statutorily designated recipients. So when the program was first established in 2000, there were just three recipients: the University of Alaska for a 52% amount of the funding, Kotzebue Training Center for 16%, and then Alaska Vocational Technical Center, AVTEC, for 32%. In 2001, the distribution was updated to include the Galena Project Education Training Center, which was ultimately given to the Galena Interior Learning Academy, or GILA. Then in 2004, there were two further recipients added: SAVEC, or the Southwest Alaska Vocational Education Center, and the Ute People's Learning Center, both for a 4% distribution. On the next slide, in 2008, there were four more recipients added, including Delta Partners for Progress, Amundsen Educational Center, NACTEC, or Northwest Alaska Career and Technical Center, and University of Alaska Southeast, which was briefly given its own allocation for a short period of time. Then on the next slide, this was the reauthorization in 2014. At that time, Illisagavik College in Ukiagvik was added for a 5% distribution. And this list of 10 recipients and the places that the regions that are distributed to was reauthorized again in 2017, and then most recently last year in 2020. At this time, on the next slide, slide 8, the current TVEP distribution chart proposed for FY22 is listed on the far right column in black. This was updated most recently in mid-March. As you can see, even with the fluctuations of COVID last year, the recipients had taken a hit between FY20 and FY21. That was ultimately, with a COVID supplemental, ended up being a little bit higher than was expected. And even with the fluctuations of this past year and draws from unemployment, this has been a relatively stable source of funding for TVEP recipients. And at this time, just briefly before questions, I'd like to just walk through the sectional of the bill. If on House Bill 100, Section 1 is really the substance of the bill. This is where we're extending the reauthorization date to 2024. And the list of 10 recipients and the percentages for distribution are listed as well in Section 1. In Section 2 of the bill, we're just adding a retroactivity clause, and Section 3 is an effective date. And that concludes the presentation.
Thank Questions you. From committee members?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know when the program first got started, there was a clause to have it terminate, and it has been reauthorized several times, but it seems to me that the success of the program is clearly evident. I'm wondering, has the sponsor considered taking off the sunset date or extending it for a longer period?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I believe your question was, should we extend it indefinitely instead of having a renewal every 3 years?
Extend it or remove the date so it becomes a permanent program?
Yeah, thank you for the question. That came up in House Finance, I believe. Someone called in with the same question. I'm sort of, I could see it both ways. It is a good program. It does need to be renewed. It was renewed last year, so the every year renewal seems a bit much, that's for sure. I know the list of programs has been changed periodically, so maybe having some sort of reauthorization period allows people to re-examine those recipients. It hasn't changed, though, in 6 or 7 years, so I guess the real question is, do you want to lock in these recipients at these numbers indefinitely? Of course, you could come revisit it, but maybe if it was had no expiration date, it wouldn't be revisited. But that's, I guess, a question for this committee.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have a list? I'm going through here trying to figure out just an easily identifiable list of the number of participants that have attended each one of these learning institutions and the number who have successfully completed the program.
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, that is in the TVEP annual report, and I will try to find that slide for you.
We'll take a brief of these. Back on the record. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It and looks like it's on just for the public. There's a technical and vocational education program report, and there's some information on page 2 there, and there's also some performance data on page 6. Thank you.
And Senator Wilikowski, the next time we bring the bill up, we could go, if you want to go a little deeper, we can
have the Department of Labor online as well.
Thank you. Other questions? We're going to have invited testimony. Senator Wilson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. On a previous bill, we had a alleged legal memo that questioned the constitutionality of the TFIT funding. Just wondering if the sponsor of that bill got a similar memo from alleged legal talking about some of the constitutionality of funding some of these technical voc rehab programs that are not publicly funded programs that are privately funded.
To the chair, Senator Wilson, I haven't been made aware of the constitutionality of funding. Would you say private, some of the private institutions on the list as opposed to the public ones?
Correct.
Yeah. I haven't received information on that.
Just through the chair to Senator Wilson, in the times we've had this bill drafted and spoken with Ledge Legal, they haven't provided any advice to that effect.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr.
Follow-up?
Follow-up then. Then, yes, Mr. Chair, maybe that's something that we can get is a clear definition of that, because in a memo to another bill, that was a question in terms of the constitutionality of this program, the Lasso Scholars, and a couple of other programs as well. So I'm just concerned about that challenge that could arise by funding these programs.
Thank you. Any other comments before we go to invited testimony?
This is Senator Von Imhoff. I have a quick question to build on Senator Wilson's question.
Senator Von Imhoff, go ahead. I'm sorry, I couldn't see you.
So I see, just to build upon that, I see 2% of the allocation was going to Edmondson Education Center. And when I looked that up, it says it is a faith-based nonprofit located in Saldana. So faith-based leads me to believe there's a religious component to it. And I think that could be potentially unconstitutional if we take a look at it closer. And I'm just curious why we'd be giving public money to a faith-based organization.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I know that that question has come up before, not necessarily faith, the question of it being faith-based, but just the efficacy of this program. So I think that was perhaps the intent of holding this over for 1 year last year. Since that time, no one's brought strong objection to it. But based on its status as a faith-based education center, as opposed to the other ones that are either public, and I believe there's some private ones in there as well, we certainly can reconnect with Ledge Legal and dive a little deeper on that.
Okay, sounds like we got a couple. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wool, I appreciate what you're doing with this bill here. But to answer to address some of the Amundsen Education Center, I know that from my district, they have had a very active outreach to people from my district to go on down to Soldotna and work on or learn how to go ahead and get some technical knowledge to get jobs out in rural Alaska. And so because of that, I'm certainly in favor of whatever's going on, whether it's constitution or not. I know there's been questions on that in the past, but I, at least at this point, it's been a very strong program and very successful for students that have come from my district out down to Soldotna.
Thank you. Comments? Other comments before we go to public testimony? We're not moving the bill today. We're just asking the questions. It's good. It's a good program. Invited testimony is from the Associate Vice President of the University of Alaska, Terry Cothran. Are you online, ma'am?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Could you put yourself on the record and please continue with your testimony?
Certainly. Thank you, Co-Chair Bishop and committee members for hearing this bill, and Representative Wool and his staff for introducing it. For the record, my name is Terry Cothran, Associate Vice President of Workforce Development at the University of Alaska. As Alaska's job loss continues to be well below pre-pandemic employment, the reauthorization of the Technical Vocational Education Program will provide critical funding for short-term career and technical education programs across the state and support Alaska's economic recovery by reskilling and upskilling Alaskans for employment. I'll just highlight a few items from the presentation that is in your packet. As a TVEP recipient, the university utilizes its funds as a single allocation within the university system. The program is administered through a competitive request for proposal or grant process for industry-specific, on-the-job, and classroom training to address high demand and regional workforce needs. This process supports collaboration and leveraging resources to increase efficiencies across the university and state while maintaining the flexibility to be responsive to industry. In FY20, the university utilized TVEP to train 4,320 Alaskans for jobs in mining, oil and gas, fisheries, seafood, maritime, construction, IT, health, aviation, and more. As Representative Wool and his staff shared, this program has been in place for more than 20 years and has a proven track record. In FY20, the average cost per participant among all TVEP recipients was $1,349. The university has continued to be a top performer, averaging $1,300 per participant, with nearly 78% being employed following their training. In some programs, such as process technology, 89% are working in Alaska within a year of graduating and have a 78.3% wage growth within 5 years. Or graduates from our CNA programs that have a 93.5% employment rate and an entry-level position that leads to other high-demand healthcare occupations. The University of Alaska strongly supports a 3-year or longer reauthorization of TVEP to provide a stable source of funding to train Alaskans for jobs in Alaska and get them back to work as quickly as possible. Thank you for the opportunity to provide this testimony this morning.
Thank you, Terry. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the testimony. I just ran running some rough numbers myself, and you said the average per student was about $1,300, or per participant rather, was around $1,300 or so. And it looks like Amundsen, the average per participant is $11,890. And it looks like they've got pretty good success rate as far as employment goes, but I'm wondering why they're so, it's 7-8 times higher than just about any other, any of these other educational centers.
Senator, excuse me, Representative Wolf.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. I think the numbers are just calculations of how much money the institution get divided by how many graduates, and they have a low number of graduates. Again, one can, this is the process for, because it comes up every three, or this takes 1 year, to examine some of these and change some of the numbers if one were to wish. I don't know what, if they're, graduation rate is pretty steady at 11. I think that's what the number was on that chart. Or if this is a, if it's in a low period, if this has been their average, and I don't have the historical data on them, but obviously some places like University of Alaska, which has 3,500 or so participants, will have a lot different averaging than a school with 11.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Having the TVAC, I have it on my iPad here, open to the 2020 annual report, and on, I think it's page 6, it does show performance measurements, and 1 year after employment, I never saw the 90% number. The I see a couple of them are even less than half, at 45% 1 year after exit, couple 63%, couple just barely 53%. Avtech is just, not just, but it's 53.3% employed 1 year after exit. So I'm not sure where the 80s and 90s percent came out of, because page 6 paints a little bit of a different story.
Yeah, you're correct. And Admonson is showing an 86% employment after 12 months. And 93% as well after 1 to 12 months after exit. So
yes, and unfortunately that is the religious institution. I just, my comment on that is, if we're going to give money, public money, to a religious institute, then let's just be consistent across all sectors, including Department of K-12, if we're going to do that.
Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, and just on that, on Amundsen, if you look at page 2, and they're getting $249,700, and you divide that by 21 participants, that's $11,890 per participant when compared to the average of 1,300. So it's 10 times, almost 9 times more that they're getting. Their success rate is good. Just something for us to evaluate, I guess.
Yeah, this would be a good conversation. Committee would have the Department of Labor back up next time, because they can talk about the specific career that they're training these folks in as well. So I'm sure there's a direct correlation there. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Certainly, as I pointed out, that the people from my district have gone there and have come back with a very high success rate. And I think to look at their success rate is more important than to look at what's going on as far as constitutionality goes. But if you want to look at what's in the past, what we've done is the question that surrounds the Blaine Amendment in the Alaska Constitution, where several states have these amendments, and the U.S. Supreme Court certainly has started to go ahead and recognize that, and because of that, Amundsen Education Center has been continued on with the funding from the state, and I'm still fairly concerned that we're not putting as much emphasis on the success rate, as you pointed out, of Amundsen Education Center compared to some of the others that are clearly head and shoulders above the other programs that are out there. And I think we need to concentrate on what the success rate is, not so much the other issues that are out there that we certainly have to wrestle with.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? We're going to go to public testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I have one more question.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So just talking about the Kenai Peninsula, where Adamson Education Center is located, is there any money going to the Kenai Peninsula College that has a tech program? That's the first question. And then I understand that Nome has a Northwest Alaska Career and Technical Center. How is that faring?
Terry, could you answer Senator Von Imhoff's question as to step dollars for the Kenai Peninsula, please? College?
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, there is funding that goes through to the Kenai Peninsula College, as well as their satellite campus in Ketchumak, the Ketchumak Bay campus in Homer. And currently, funding process that process tech program, as well as some of their health programs.
And I'd just like to add one finer point, Senator Von Imhoff. The Kenai College also is home to MAPS, the Mine Training and Petroleum Institute. When you read the report, there are different segments within the university that performs better than others. The Mine Training and Petroleum Institute employs 88% of the graduates out of the mine training program. Just as a footnote. And you had a second part to your question, Senator Von Imhoff, and I forgot that one.
It's the Northwest Alaska Career and Technical Center in Nome. Our students, I see we had Northwest 31 students go there in 2020. How did they fare, and is that a good place for kids or adults to stay in Nome versus going to Sultana, or what's being offered in Sultana that's not being offered in Nome?
Our next public speaker, Mr. Walworth from Nome, is going to speak to that point. And if you would give us just a minute and let him speak to that point, and if you have questions after that, you could direct your question to him. But he's the resident expert in Nome on that program, and he's ready in the queue if you'd like to wait and hear his testimony. Is that a yes or a no, Senator Von Imhoff?
That sounds great. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Walworth, Director, Northwest Alaska Career and Technical Center. Can you hear us, Doug?
Yes, I can. And heard the conversation leading up, so good morning for the record. My name is Doug Walworth. I'm the Director of the Northwestern Alaska Career and Technical Center, also known as NACTEC, the Nome-based Regional Training Center. So we support the reauthorization of TVEP. The Regional Training Center Network, which is supported by TVEP funding, provides autonomy and flexibility to meet the unique needs of each region's priority industries. The Regional Training Centers provide workforce development training otherwise needing to occur out of region and at a greater expense to the state. So as one example, in our region, the Nome Census area, healthcare training is a top priority. So Norton Sound Health Corporation, our largest regional employer, partners with NACTEC to deliver dual credit high school courses such as introduction to health field or emergency trauma technician training. The TVEP funding supports industry certification in our healthcare strand, which transitions our high school students immediately into employment as certified nurse aides, village health aides, and personal care attendants. So in addition to healthcare needs, In our region, Nome is poised for several large projects addressing U.S. national interests. In December, Congress authorized a $379 million appropriation for the construction of an Arctic deep draft port in Nome. In January, the U.S. government designated Graphite Creek as a high-priority infrastructure project located just 40 miles from Nome. This is the highest grade and largest known large flake graphite deposit in the United States. So a vitally important workforce development training program supporting both of these projects is driver education training. So 3-4 years ago, when the cuts occurred that eliminated the Nome DMV, NACTEC has stepped in. We provide the only adult and high school driver education training in the Nome census area. We're also a DMV-approved third-party road test examiner in Nome, and over the last year since COVID hit, I believe have been administering the only road test in the region. So to the question that was posed by Senator Von Imhoff about NACTEC's role and where adults may lead the region. I think this is one particular area that we find getting people employed into a job, that driver's license, is imperative, and there's simply no options out in the villages for such training. So in closing, as our state budget is restricted, shedding workers and training dollars alike, it becomes critically important to make earlier outreach to develop a technically skilled workforce. NACTEC supports TVEP reauthorization efforts and its expansive reach across our large state to train workforces locally to best meet local needs. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff, do you have any questions for Mr. Walworth?
No, I mean, I appreciate the explanation, and then I understand that there's going to be some specialty locations around the state. You know, for example, Seward has some of the best ship piloting programs that cannot be duplicated or difficult to duplicate, so I get that. But I just, one of the questions that I have is, I think the previous speaker just indicated that we're using some of this TVET money for high schools. Is that an appropriate use? Are we commingling with Department of Education dollars? You know, I understand that vocational technology training does start in the high school years, but is that something that TVAC has traditionally funded as high school students versus adult re-education? Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that the use of high school students coming on in so they can continue on their education, otherwise after they graduate from high school, there's an issue where the continuation, if they haven't been exposed to some of the vocational issues or vocational education opportunities that are out there, it's a lot easier to go ahead and have them continue on with their education and not have a break in it, because once they break, then they tend never to come back. Mr. Chairman, I would like to ask a question of Mr. Walworth, if I could.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Walworth, as you looked at the numbers, Senator Von Imhoff pointed out that NACTEC looks like a 35% or so employee achievement as opposed to some of the other programs that are out there. Can you give us an explanation why those numbers aren't higher than as compared to some of the other institutions that are throughout the state, some of which are also in rural Alaska?
Through the chair to Senator Olson, I guess I would note that across all of the TVEP recipients, you'll see that there is a population of adults served and high school students served. There's certainly disparity of what that percentage is, and I believe as you look to that, you can see the footprint of the local impact and what the local decision-making was. So in our region, the Bering Straits region, prior to TVEP, the graduation rates for students averaged about 38% for the 5 years prior to TVEP. That role of career and technical education has been very important for engaging students and keeping them in school on the pathway to graduate. So as I noted with the healthcare, with the introduction to health field and ETT, these are courses that when students are in 9th, 10th, and 11th grade, they get engaged, they get interested, and these are the courses that guide students on into the certified nursing assistant strand, the health aid strand, to become personal care attendants. So you're going to see that percentage of employment is lower because there's a higher percentage of the students that are served with the TVEP dollars that are in high school as opposed to adults. But one of the things that I noted, there was a research study from 2009 that talked about the cost of a dropout, and at that time it was just a little under $300,000 per dropout. That since the time of TVEP coming on, the graduation rates in the region have climbed from 38% to, I believe it was nearly 78% over the most recent 3 to 4 years. It's a difference per graduating class in Bering Strait School District of $12 million lifetime earnings per graduating class. So for a nominal amount coming in, the impact is profound of what it makes in each and every graduating class. But as you noted, Senator Olson, that element of getting students through training. So we literally take high school students as they graduate, walk the stage right into a health aid training program or CNA training program. They're working during the summertime. They're not waiting through the summer to leave the region to get a certificate and come back. And had we, if we were to wait for that to occur, we simply just wouldn't see the continuation of students pursuing post-secondary ed with that lapse of months within in between.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
Mr. Woolworth, as you've looked at the last year where we've been complicated by the COVID epidemic, pandemic that's throughout the world, what do you expect next year's percentages to look like with the active participation of people throughout the district where they're not hampered by travel?
Yes, through the chair to Senator Olson, that is something that as you look at the TVEP report for this year, those numbers are COVID impacted, so effectively programs shutting down around March. So it's probably a more accurate representation to look at the 3 years of data prior to last year, and I would guess that's true for most of the recipients that's there. We anticipate a return. We're finally here just because of COVID and the constraints of village travel, looking at getting first village-based training of sending instructors out to villages to deliver CTE training, whereas it's been known based up until this point in time. So we anticipate and hope that those numbers are going to climb next year, and when we come out of this COVID pandemic, we'll eventually return to normal, hopefully in the year after.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And thank you, Doug. Senator Von Emhoff, any further questions of Mr. Woolworth?
No, thank you. Not at this time.
Thank you. All right. Doug, thanks for what you do up there. You do a good job. We appreciate it. And I just, on that note to Senator Olson's comments, I don't have to say it here to this committee, but I'll just put it on the record to those people listening at home. We are on the precipice, maybe, of looking at an 8-year infrastructure bill coming to Alaska and the United States. And this is a good timing to bring this bill before the committee, because the numbers that are talked about, you're going to need have an increased workforce. And thank God that we have a workforce delivery system in this state in place to meet that demand. So I have no further questions on this bill. I'm
going to last comment, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
I just want to point out as well that the Nome Deep Port project seems to be progressing along. The funding has been, a majority of the funding has been secured both from federal sources, mainly with the military and its importance there. And with that, I anticipate, like you say, within the next 7 to 8 years, they're planning on having a fair amount of construction activity there in the Nome area.
Yep. Okay. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Von Emhoff.
Thank you. This is an excellent program, and I wholly support it. And to your point that you just stated, training our next generation of workforce workers is paramount. But I also want to make sure that this program is being utilized as is it intended. And I have received some emails in my office from folks who say that admit this program is very good, but perhaps is the money being used as intended? Is it being spent in workforce development, or is it being spent particularly perhaps on other ways? Maybe it's something that we should look into, perhaps with an audit or just a deeper dive. Are we competing programs within one particular community? Does this dilute the programs? Does it spread it too thin? Is it something that we may want to focus on one program and make it very robust and very high performing versus spreading it out to too many places, such as, you know, a mile wide and an inch deep, something along that line. And so those are just my two comments based on the feedback that I'm hearing from some folks in my office, and I will be happy to send those to you, Chair Bishop, so you have them in writing. Thank you.
That would be fine. Thank you. Okay. Public testimony is open. I forgot to open it. Now it's closed. And Any further committee discussion? There's an amendment deadline, Wednesday, May 5th at 5 p.m. We're setting the bill aside. Next, we're going to take a brief at ease so we let presenters change out. Briefing. Back on the record. Next up is SB 9, Alcohol Beverage Control. This is the first hearing. Our intention is to hear an introduction, set it aside. Today's presentation will be by Senator Machicki, Mr. Jackson, staff to Senator Machicki. Available for questions online, we have Anna Brawley, Sarah Oates, Tiffany Hall, and Lee Ellis. So, with that, Senator Machicki, the floor is yours, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Senate Finance Committee. Thanks for having a hearing on Senate Bill 9 today. For the record, my name is Peter Machicki, representing District O on the Kenai. Just wanted to remind you, we don't talk about past bills, but this bill has passed the Senate twice, I think, unanimously, and it want to emphasize this legislation is a collaborative, years-long effort from a large group of stakeholders. We have about 16,000 hours invested. Why does that matter? It matters because public safety, public health, the industry, the AMCO board, and ABC and the legislature came together over those times for a delicate balance on meeting the goals of Title IV, which is promoting a fair business climate, protection of public health and safety, limiting youth access to alcohol, promoting responsible alcohol use and reducing the harms of overconsumption, implementing change without negatively harming existing businesses and responsible operators, and expanding local control for municipalities. The key concepts are sticking with the three-tier system. That's how we do alcohol in this state and most others, separation of manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers to prevent inappropriate monopolies, licensure, restructuring and organizing the licensing system to include clearly defined categories of licenses, and regulating the number of licenses available in each community by type. I look forward to working with you. This bill really is about balance, reorganization, and fairness. So the vast majority, 90% of the bill that you have before you is just reorganizing a hodgepodge of statutes that have been done over 35 years. In the past, when someone wanted to do something different, you would have to pass a bill. This actually allows, it kind of, through licensing, permitting, and endorsements, it allows a business operator to choose how their business is going to operate, and they would not be required to pass a new statute for that to occur. So what I want to say is that not every single bar owner supports this bill, but Char supports this bill, who represents the bar owners. Not every manufacturer supports this bill, but the Brewers Guild supports this bill, which represents the manufacturers. Same thing about public safety. They'd like for it to be a lot stricter, but Recover Alaska, the troopers, and PSEA supports this bill because of the balance that was struck in putting this piece of legislation together. So at this time of COVID recovery, this is very important for the industry. Although alcohol is the number one, no matter who you ask, is the number one substance abuse problem in our state, it's also a very important industry. So we're struck a balance that improves the public safety aspect, yet provides some tools for the industry to be successful as well. And Mr. Chairman, if it's okay with you, we actually have a Title IV coordinator named Anna Brawley, who's with Agnew Beck. She's been working with us for the last several years, and she can run through. I asked her to expedite going through the presentation, but she can run through it if you would like.
That would be fine. Any questions of Senator Michicki from committee members before Ms. Brawley walks us through the slide deck? Seeing none, Ms. Brawley?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here.
All right. Conrad, Mr. Jackson, are you going to run the slides?
Yes.
Thank
yes,
you. I am, Senator. Okay, so I will look to the table to see who's got a question at the end of each slide, and then we'll move on. So, Ms. Brawley, if you would like to kick off your presentation, please.
Yes, thank you. For the record, my name is Anna Brawley. I'm Title IV Review Coordinator up here in Anchorage. And if you would like to skip actually to slide five, I don't want to cover ground that the Senator has already covered. So slide five really illustrates the overall goals of this process. As Senator Michicki said, the goal is really striking a balance and finding a way that our state's alcohol laws can work better for everybody. Are maybe familiar with these goals from prior work. So again, it's looking at a clear legal framework, holding business owners accountable to make sure that we're serving alcohol responsibly, and public health benefits such as limiting youth access to alcohol. So on slide six, this is just an overview of the wide variety of topics that the stakeholders discussed and made recommendations, many of which are in the bill today. And again, the focus was really on licensing, role and functions of the ABC board and AMCO staff, underage drinking, reducing underage drinking, regulating internet sales, and then most of the bill is actually really just reorganizing the statutes and policies that already exist. Next slide. This is just a general overview of the way that we do regulate alcohol. We have what's called the three-tier system. So the pure version of this system has different businesses making beer, wine, or spirits, and then the wholesalers is a separate type of business, and then selling to retailers who sell to the public. So a lot of the discussion was really how to keep the general structure of the system in place, but to be more flexible and respond to the way that the current industry operates. So next slide, slide eight. The next three slides are part of a graphic that really illustrates how Senate Bill 9 basically reorganizes the licenses that already exist, and so that they're easy to understand. They follow the general organization of the three-tier system, and also how there's more options for businesses such as endorsements, which I'll cover in a few slides. So to slide 9, the retail licenses, again, those serving the public and are available in our various communities like bars, package stores, restaurants, that sort of thing are illustrated here. Again, most of these already exist in the law. There are a few new licenses being proposed that I'll cover in a later slide that are indicated with the gold border. So slide 10, again, this is more retail licenses, but it's important to understand that there are several licenses specifically responding to the fact that we have a strong tourism and hospitality sector. And so they are not tied to population limits. They are really designed to serve visitors to a community. And so so some of those already exist. And again, there's more options proposed in the statute. So next slide, slide 11. This is an example of ways that the bill is proposing more flexibility. So for manufacturing licenses, currently, if you are a brewery, for example, you have one license that allows you to make beer as well as sell it to the public on a limited basis. So the bill proposes really giving more options to those businesses, so not just having that limited retail license, but being able to own a bar or a restaurant or a package store, which is not allowed today. And so, again, this slide illustrates for breweries, but this would be true for wineries and distilleries as well. So seeing more of that kind of brew pub business model versus a limited retail space. Next slide 10, or sorry, slide 12. This is really just illustrating again what's already in the law, but just clarifying, if you do have a limited retail license, how much of each product type you can serve. And that's really tied to essentially the alcohol equivalent or how, what a standard serving size is for each product. Next slide, 13. So this and the following slide illustrate the concept of endorsements. And so rather than, as Senator Michicki said, creating a new license type for every single business model that you can think of, this would allow more flexibility by adding endorsements to licenses. So whether you are allowing a larger premises or allowing activities such as sampling that wouldn't be allowed under the base license. So this going forward is a way to reorganize a lot of the inconsistent ways that we've expanded licenses in the past, but also looking forward to the future, more options. So on slide 14, that simply lists what those are. Again, many of these actually do exist in the law now, but aren't kind of standardized or aren't easily added to a license. So one example that's being added is slide 15, and that would be to allow for package stores to provide free samples to customers on site. So currently you cannot consume alcohol, you can only purchase it for off-site use. So this again would put limits on that based on the product type, and it also gives the business flexibility to offer combinations. And again, this is something that that we are not allowed to do today, but is common in other places. So moving on to slide 16, another part of the bill standardizes permits. So some permits are defined in statute, others are in regulation, and they're not necessarily, they don't have the consistent requirements that would be helpful for all permit holders. So slide 17 really illustrates the list of these, and some of them are held by licensees, other ones are held by nonprofits holding fundraisers and so on. So again, just really reorganizing what's allowed. And then on slide 18, again, a new permit that's proposed, just as an example, is, again, for package stores. So this would be not just providing free samples, but allowing them to have tasting events on their premises. So maybe they're hosting a dinner with a wine pairing or offering, you know, a variety of different sakes or liquors to sample for their customers. So it does put some boundaries on that and limits to how often they can do that, but again, expanding what package stores are allowed to do. The next few slides, starting with 19, illustrate the population limits. So this is one of the kind of core policies of Title IV, which is that the number of licenses in each community is limited by the number of residents. And again, there's exceptions to this, especially for tourism serving licenses, but essentially this is how each community it's determined how many of each license type they're allowed to have. So on slide 20, you can see that it's illustrating what happens with a city and a borough within that, or a city within that borough, that they each have their own set of licenses, and again, some are subject to population limits, others are exempt from population limits. So the bill doesn't propose, throwing this system out. Certainly there are health and safety rules for wanting to, or reasons for wanting to limit the number of licenses, and recognizing that we do have the system in place and that there are existing licensees who bought into this system. So what the stakeholders did discuss was how to, accommodate and allow more flexibility, especially for these small cities with a limited number of licenses. So the next slide, 21, is one of these. It proposes creating a seasonal restaurant license. REPL is a restaurant or eating place license. And so for smaller communities, this would allow for essentially having more restaurants operating on a limited basis during the tourist season, whatever that is, whether it's only summer or maybe they're open for part of the winter as well, but really giving more options there outside of the population limits for that community. The next slide is slide 22 is looking at public convenience licenses. So this is a system in current law that allows you to apply for a restaurant and gather signatures, and then the board can issue that restaurant. But the process has really been cumbersome for the applicant, for AMCO, for the local government, and so the proposal is really to just convert those restaurants to full restaurants that can be sold to a new location or owner, unlike the ones that can be today, and again, really just streamlining the system. The next slide, 23, is another proposal to, again, expand options for licenses in communities. So essentially this would allow a municipality to prepare a petition for more alcohol licenses in their community. So not a single petition from one person, but really allowing the community itself more local control over the number and type of licenses that they would like to see. So they petitioned the ABC board to allow for more licenses of a certain type in their jurisdiction that would be available. And if the board decides that they don't want to grant that application, then the city has recourse to petition again to revise their application. So the next slide, 24, also addresses again that situation of a small city within a larger borough. In current law, you can actually relocate a bar license, a beverage dispensary license, from a borough to within a city in that borough. So this would simply also allow that for package stores. So again, recognizing that we're not creating a new license, but are able to relocate it more toward a city center or a main street or somewhere where there's more concentration of business. The next slide, 25. This really shows things that are already illegal in federal law and have to do with, again, protecting especially retailers from a wholesaler or a manufacturer basically telling them what to do, not allowing them to sell their competitors' products or otherwise using kind of their market power to control their behavior. So these are things that are already illegal in federal law but are not being enforced, and so most states have put these into state law to allow an agency such as AMCO for Alaska to actually enforce these. And this was something that the manufacturers and wholesalers brought to the stakeholder group themselves, saying that we would like to see these kind of protections in the law. So the next slide, 26, another proposal in the bill is to basically, in many cases, increase but really make consistent the fees that the different license types pay, making sure that if you're selling similar products or you're a similar type of license that you're paying the same fees. And that is relevant because the ABC Board and AMCO is a receipts-funded agency, and so the fees being set in statute means that they haven't been increased for many years, possibly all the way back to 1980. So this really would also help the agency secure resources to do its job, so not just enforcement, which is certainly important, but also having the time and staff to do education, outreach to local governments and to licensees, and help people basically provide good customer service to those businesses. Slide 27 simply illustrates that not only would that benefit ABC Board and AMCO and the licensees they serve, but also local governments. So there's an existing provision in statute that some of the license fees that go to the state are also shared with cities for licenses in their jurisdiction for enforcement and administration. So that would also benefit those agencies. And slide 28 also is having to do with the role of the ABC board. It would ensure that they are partnering with other agencies who work on alcohol education, such as Department of Health and Social Services, to provide really what they're subject matter experts in, which is Title IV itself. So how to follow the laws, how to be a responsible licensee, you know, issues about underage drinking, really making sure that they're coordinating with other agencies to provide that knowledge. So the next three slides illustrate an issue that we have here and has become an increasing issue over time, which is internet sales. So Alaska is one of the only states with no rules for internet sales of alcohol. And we've seen that that especially in the last year or so, e-commerce has become you know, much more standard, and because we aren't regulating the sale of internet or the internet sale of alcohol in Alaska, we really don't know how much is coming into the state. And those orders are not paying state excise tax. So this would simply follow most other states in terms of having a system to track that and to make sure that those sellers are following the rules and paying into our excise taxes.
Ms. Brawley, could you pause there for a minute, please?
Sure.
I have a question for the bill sponsor. Could you, because you're intimately the resident expert on this bill in the Senate, didn't we not fix part of that last year with an amendment in Labor and Commerce for wine, taxing wine coming into the state?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we did in this bill, but this bill did not pass. So we obviously have more work to do. If I understand your question correctly.
Thank you. Please continue, Ms. Brawley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, this is Anna Brawley, Title IV Review Coordinator. So starting with slide 30, these two slides illustrate how that would work. So essentially, there would be a license type, and this is like the system that most other states already use, and an out-of-state business could have this license as well as in-state. They would be required to check whether the customer ordering is 21 or older, whether they're in a local option area. We certainly don't want alcohol being shipped out to dry communities if they've already limited that. And there would also be a limit in terms of personal use per year. And then on slide 31, the other piece of it is really making sure that the carriers, such as UPS, FedEx, you know, delivery companies, are also following those rules since they are the ones delivering the alcohol. So making sure that they deliver to an adult, that they don't leave the product on the doorstep for somebody to grab, and again, that they have policies in place to train their employees. The next slide, 32, this is a system that already exists in law, which is for a local option area, again, a dry or damp community. There's monthly limits to what you can order for personal use, and there's a system, a database that licensees use as well as ABC Board and law enforcement to ensure that system is being followed. So on slide 33, the only proposed change in the bill is really to provide communities with that really rich data that's not available now. So again, not disclosing individual orders or private information, but giving the community some information about how much alcohol is being shipped into their community each year. So this would allow for that data to be shared on a limited basis and kept in the system longer than it is currently.
Ms. Brawley, we have a question from Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going back to slide 30, it says the bill would create a winery direct shipment license and allow online alcohol sales only from U.S. wineries and Alaska package stores. I'm just curious, sales from brewing companies, sales from distillers, are they allowed to sell online under this bill, or do they want to and they're not being allowed to? I'm just, what's going on with that?
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. So most states do have a similar system to this where they only allow shipment of wine. There are some states that have allowed shipment of other products. My understanding is also that UPS and FedEx themselves, they won't ship other alcohol products commercially other than wine, and they require having basically a contract with that winery to be able to ship. So this is really putting us in line with most other states.
Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you. I have a follow-up to that question. So is it just not within Alaska, other entities, breweries or distilleries that also may want to ship, or has there been any concern from any other industry that they would like, or any other interest group that would like to see other items outside of wine that could be shipped by other shippers within our state? Is that a possibility?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I won't speak for other industry sectors as to whether they would support or oppose this. I do know that the stakeholder group didn't hear opposition to this to date from other industry stakeholders. I do know that, as I said, some other states do sell. Sometimes they only allow breweries to sell and not by retail, so it really depends on the state. And I guess I would defer to the industry on the other question.
Senator Machicki, I don't know if this is the appropriate section, but I think I'm getting close. Would this allow an Alaskan distiller to sell spirits online to the lower 48?
Well, two things, Mr. Chairman. Lee Ellis would be a really good person to ask the last question of on. We did not hear from others that had any sort of business model that resulted in shipping other, beer or spirits on shipping outside. I know that there are some folks here in the state that do ship wine to the lower 48, and they would continue to be able to do so. But you might ask Lee about the why there's not opposition to wine only. We as Ms. Brawley said, we had no interest when we were having this discussion. Primarily, most states are doing the wine only, and right now, this not only regulates internet alcohol sales, but it also levels the playing field because they are not paying excise taxes from other states to Alaska, and anyone that sells within the state, of course, is required to pay that excise tax.
Senator Wilson, would you want to repose your question to Mr. Ellis? Or Mr. Ellis, did you hear the question, or are you prepared to answer it, or do you need to hear it again?
Through the chair, yes, sir, I can answer that question if you'd like me to.
Please.
Through the chair, for the record, my name is Lee Ellis, president of the Brewers Guild. So that's a two-part question. As far as shipping out of state, shipping directly into any state is regulated by that state. This is Alaska, regulates anything coming into this state. So brewers in Alaska or distilleries can ship to other states just depending on what that state's regulations are. UPS does ship beer. In fact, they had a pretty strong campaign advocating their beer shipping capabilities when the beginning of the COVID pandemic started. As far as Alaska, brewers had not expressed particular interest in this area prior to COVID, but it has definitely become an area of interest. We have not pushed the issue too much this year because we haven't spent much time with the rest of the stakeholders discussing their feelings towards it. I will say that Alaska does have a bit of an unfair law currently for personal importation. So it does allow breweries and distilleries from other states to ship their liquor and beer here. However, we as in-state breweries and distilleries are not allowed to ship directly to consumers within the state of Alaska.
Thank you for that answer. Senator Wilson, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, then I'm interested in helping trying to level that playing field. And I'll work with the bill sponsor.
Thank you. Ms. Brawley, seeing no further questions from the table, please continue.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Anna Brawley. So we are on slide 34, and we just have a few left, and they have to do with penalties. So another piece of the Title IV project was really looking at, again, enforcement, and not to the point of you know, issuing tickets for every single thing, but simply to make sure that the laws are being followed and that we have responsible operators. So currently in Title IV, almost everything, unless it's otherwise defined, is a Class A misdemeanor. So that's everything from serving a minor to having gambling on premises, all the way down to not having the right sign posted. And so the group really discussed how to rebalance those penalties to make it easier for those minor offenses to be dealt with, and for the licensee to know that they happened, but also still keeping anything that's a serious crime and something that we, you know, certainly want to prevent happening to still be prosecuted at the level that it is now. So on slide 35, it essentially illustrates the three different types of offenses, and the proposal in the bill is to move a lot of those minor things, again, to minor offense or violation. So allowing the ABC board or another local enforcement agency to issue a fine. And then, again, keeping anything that was a serious offense, either as a felony, as it is in the law now, or retaining it as a misdemeanor. So the other thing the group discussed to slide 36 is really how do you incentivize good behavior from businesses. So one is that they need to know upfront, you know, if a violation has happened on their premises, and two, there needs to be an incentive for corrective action. And so the proposal is to change the penalty for an employee serving a minor to a minor offense with a $500 ticket, which is certainly you know, certainly not a misdemeanor, but certainly still a swift enforcement action against something that we don't want to see. So either serving a minor or over-serving someone who's already intoxicated on premises. And in addition to that, the licensee themselves would receive a direct penalty, which is not what happens now. And this would be not simply when their license is being renewed, maybe a year and a half from now, but so that they know it happened immediately, you know, especially if the employee or their manager wasn't forthcoming. And so this gets the licensee's attention. Ideally, hopefully, they correct the action, and then it will help the ABC board as these violations, you know, if they do stack up, that they can really see who's being a responsible operator and who needs to have more corrective action.
Ms. Brawley, we have a question from Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Yes. Chair. This the standard here is knowing, correct? So if you knowingly serve a minor, serve a 15-year-old kid, we're dropping that down from a misdemeanor to a $500 fine? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, the standard, to my knowledge, is knowingly, and of course, Department of Law could speak more to the details of that. But the group did discuss, you know, the implications of changing this, and the reality is now a lot of these cases simply don't move forward. And so the group really discussed what's the most effective way to achieve the enforcement goal, which is that this doesn't happen in the first place. And so for the misdemeanors, there's a mandatory court appearance. There's, you know, it often doesn't move forward at the law enforcement level even because people don't feel like it's going to, you know, it's not going to move through the system. And so that was the discussion from the stakeholder group with this recommendation.
Follow-up, Senator?
Is there... If someone does this multiple times, does the penalty grow at some point?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the group actually discussed the system of graduated penalties, so that's not built into this proposal. Each of them is a ticket with a $500 fine, so those certainly stack up. And certainly, if the licensee is allowing this to happen, that's when the ABC board can step in and suspend a license or, you know, and that really has a serious financial impact on that licensee and is a deterrent.
Senator Wilikowski, follow up.
Do we know how many people are charged with over serving an intoxicated adult or serving a minor per year? Do we have any idea? Currently?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't have current data. That would have to come from from the court system, but the data that we did look at a few years ago, we looked at all Title IV offenses, and a good portion of them, almost half, were underage drinking, so minor consuming or minor possessing alcohol, and vanishingly few of them were these kinds of charges. I mean, there were very few to licensees generally, and there were almost none to an employee or a licensee under these statutes.
Senator Machicki.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This took a while to convince me that this is the right way to go on this particular change. I like the misdemeanor idea. However, what we learned is that the courts have higher priorities. So none of them were being prosecuted. This bill also provides a lot more enforcement just through the licensing dollars that will be available and a lot more education, so we will know. But the way that I see this working is that prior to this, the licensee didn't receive a ticket, so they may not even know that an employee has a rash of over-serving or serving the underage. Now the licensee will receive a ticket, so it goes on their record, which Ms. Brawley talked about. But an employee that's getting a lot of tickets and causing their licensee to receive tickets and knowing that they're building a docket of things that are occurring in that establishment is probably more self-correcting than what we're using today that just doesn't work. It's just not working. So this isn't this doesn't happen often, but when it does happen, it will be quite clear that you have an employee that just has a rash of these things, and the licensee is a relatively small community. Unless someone moves from that community to another one, that reputation gets out. That licensee or that employee would have a very difficult time becoming reemployed in another establishment. So we think it's the most effective to dramatically reduce something that doesn't occur very often anyway, and that is serving minors or over-serving.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions at this time, Ms. Brawley, please continue.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Anna Brawley for the record. And the last slide we have is slide 37. And this is, again, trying to solve the issue not just of protecting public health and one of our core goals, which is to reduce underage drinking, but also again to get at the to use enforcement to get at the issue. So this is something that's already in place in Anchorage and Juneau. It essentially requires that if an adult legally purchasing alcohol in a keg from a licensee, if they provide that alcohol or that keg to underage drinkers, that it can be traced back to that purchaser. So one of the issues is, you know, maybe a package store sells alcohol to an adult and not knowing where that alcohol is going to end up, and the sale is legal. So it's really the adult who's providing that alcohol who should be who the enforcement action needs to focus on. And so as the slide illustrates, if that party has adults and there's no issue, there's no enforcement, then that tag with the person's name on it and who purchased it is removed at the end, and there's no need to follow up. If that keg is confiscated at a party with a bunch of teenagers or underage drinkers, then the tag on that keg can be traced back to the person who bought it. So it's not only a protection for the adult, but also for the licensee, and again, making sure that we can trace the source of that alcohol. So that's again a public health best practice and something that we already have in a couple of our cities. So the proposal is to make this statewide.
Ms. Brawley, we have a question from Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. What would be the penalty for an adult who purchases alcohol knowingly for an underage person?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, so for a person who is not employed by a licensee or not
yes.
a licensee,
yes.
that penalty would still be a Class A misdemeanor. So the problem that this registration piece is trying to solve is that if you don't know who provided the alcohol in the first place, you can't charge them with that misdemeanor. So this would simply be an additional penalty. But I imagine that if that person is identified as the source, that they would be charged with that misdemeanor.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski, is that good? All right. Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's actually the end of my presentation, unless there's other questions.
All right. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Braley, as you look at this piece of legislation, it's my understanding that currently breweries are not allowed to have live music performed on their premises when they're having a function. However, many of the manufacturers have facilities that are able to go ahead and have nonprofit fundraising activities there with live music. Would this bill allow or change any of those factors which would allow live music?
Yes, thank you, through the chair, Senator Olson. This does allow, or I should say, it does clarify an issue that I know has come up in the past, and also invite the industry folks maybe to better speak to this. But this would allow or clarify that it is allowed to have live music on the premises of a brewery, a winery, or distillery with a retail license, and also slightly changes the closing hours such that they can serve alcohol until 10 p.m., but that they have to close at 10 p.m. as opposed to allowing people there.
Senator Machicki, would you like to comment?
Yeah, so there's more parts to that. It's kind of the Graham compromise that occurred 2 years ago, I believe it was. And that, so there's a few things that it does. If you remember on the news, the board was actually picking up, they were trying to do some regulations, making a big deal that you weren't supposed to have fun at a manufacturer's facility. Remember, no fun was allowed. So part of that compromise was that it went from a soft close at 8 p.m., which means you can order your three beers at 8 p.m. and sit there for a long time. This is now a hard close at 10. So they can serve until 10, but then the doors close at 10. Everyone's out. It limits new tasting rooms to 1 in 12,000. They can have 4 permitted events a year, but they can have community events as well. So they can have art shows. They can have community fundraisers and that sort of thing. And remember that the previous executive director of AMCA was actually terminated due to 1,200 pages of public testimony against when they tried to actually make it so you can have less fun in these facilities. So we think we struck the right balance working with all the different user groups, and that's what's in the bill today.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. During the past year, we saw lots of different innovation due to COVID, and one of those was a curbside pickup. Does curbside pickup still allow to happen under this bill?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Senator Wilson, no, it does not, and I actually think that would be helpful. I don't know if you want to speak to the stakeholder group and see what that would look like, but I think it would be helpful for the industry whether you tied it to certain situations or if we decide that it's actually working currently the way it is, that may be something to consider.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff, did you have any questions, ma'am?
No, sir. Thank you for checking in.
Yeah. Any other committee questions before we set this bill aside? Seeing none, we're setting SB9 aside. Thank you for the presentation today. To your staff and Ms. Brawley for rolling us through that. It was a great refresher. Tomorrow is May 4th, 9 a.m., HB 27, naming Irene Weber Bridge, SB 123, Energy Independence Program and Funding, SB 97, State Land Sales and Leases and Rivers, HB 69, Appropriations Operating Budget, Loans and Funds, and HB 71, Appropriations Mental Health Budget. We are adjourned.